It's Friday, April 1st. No fooling. And this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello. Coming up, President Obama hosts another nuclear security summit.
It's essential that coming out of this summit, that countries have a roadmap on how to go forward.
We have analysis on what is hoped to be achieved. Also ahead, Donald Trump makes a surprise visit to Washington. Some voters say they will move if Mr. Trump is elected president. We have some possible destinations, and we spray some British graffiti. It's all on today's International Edition. President Obama is hosting a fourth and final nuclear security summit, this one right now here in Washington. The two-day meeting has brought together world leaders from more than 50 nations on ways to better safeguard nuclear materials. On the eve of the summit, Mr. Obama, in an opinion piece in the Washington Post, said the most dangerous threat to global security and peace is the proliferation and potential use of nuclear weapons, including used by terrorists. For more on the summit, VOA White House correspondent Mary Alice Salinas briefs my International Edition colleague Susan Yockey.
In this series of summits that they've had, the first one in 2010, they have had many countries go ahead and eliminate or ship out nuclear materials. But I think everyone agrees that a lot of work still has to be done. One of the key goals is to secure loose nuclear materials around the world. And there are still many sites, there are still many areas where those materials are not properly secured and vulnerable to theft. And one of the key questions being addressed today is making sure that people like terror groups are not able to get their hands on it, or other people who have some sort of malicious intention. That's a key question moving forward. This is something Obama announced, a series, and what will happen to these kind of nuclear security meetings is still very much in question. That is after he leaves office.
And Russia's not coming to the party this time.
They just think that the summits have played out. The White House would have liked Russia to attend in a constructive way, according to a White House spokesman. But analysts are saying, look, Russia and U.S. relations are just too tense right now. This is the U.S.'s baby. You know, Obama started this series of summits, and they prefer a more international, broad sort of architecture for these kinds of things. So they're just not making it this time around. And that's a disappointment here at the White House, and it's important because Russia is such a key player, although they have to work together on many nuclear security issues like the Iran nuclear deal.
In the end, when this is all wrapped up, are we expecting a final statement or a final declaration?
Yes. Typically, they have done that. In this case, they're going to work out some nitty-gritty details. They will express their commitments they have had at this meeting, the progress that has been made. They will have an action plan with a list of multiple items that they're going to be going back to the countries and accomplishing. The key question moving forward is, what's next? How will the world, how will the international community continue to address the question of nuclear security?
Nicholas Roth is a research associate at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University. He is attending the nuclear summit here and discussed with VOA's Victor Beatty the importance of the meeting.
At this year's summit, countries are going to agree to 5 action plans that will focus on sustaining nuclear security efforts through a variety of different organizations. And it's essential that coming out of this summit, that countries have a roadmap on how to go forward, that countries make concrete commitments to strengthening nuclear security in their own countries, but also that there is a path forward.
Is one of the big issues the fact that terror groups like Islamic State could obtain a so-called dirty bomb?
The issue of the threat is a very important one. 2 years ago at the nuclear security summit, essentially no one had ever heard of the Islamic State. Within months of the 2014 nuclear security summit, they had declared a global caliphate. And what we've seen over the last 2 years is that while there's no solid evidence that a group like the Islamic State is pursuing nuclear weapons capability, if they did so, they have land, they have resources, they have global outreach, they have apocalyptic ideology, and they've demonstrated that they're capable of carrying out sophisticated attacks around the world. So if they decided to go down that route, They have as much capability as any terrorist group in history to do so. And I think that really highlights the speed at which threats can change and the need for securing nuclear material.
Nicholas, what about rogue states like North Korea and its pursuit of nuclear weapons, as well as states that seem to be failing or having great difficulty that are already nuclear armed, like Pakistan?
There are a number of countries that are of significant concern with regard to nuclear security. In a recent report that I helped co-author, we talk about three countries in particular: Russia, Pakistan, and India. And there are a number of very specific threats that all countries should guard against in terms of threats, insider threats, outsider threats involving more than one group of people, having a robust security culture. And it's important that organizations with nuclear materials and nuclear facilities are prepared to protect against those threats, but also that they understand them as well.
Nicholas Roth adds there is no question in his mind the world is safer today from the threat of nuclear terrorism than it was when the first of these summits was held. He says fewer countries have access to nuclear material and international mechanisms to guard nuclear material are stronger. We turn to our social media segment now with International Edition's G. Abby Lee joining me here in the studio to tell us the social media trends related to our top story. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
What's the best hashtag to keep us posted on the summit?
It's hashtag NSS2016, and that stands for the Nuclear Security Summit 2016. Coincidentally, that's also the handle for this year's NSS account on Twitter. Now, that account sent out only 110 tweets so far, but already has nearly 880 followers. Mm.
Gee, the White House and the State Department are tweeting throughout the day, as they usually do, but what about some specific officials?
Yeah, so not surprisingly, Secretary of State John Kerry tweeted, "Proud to join the president at hashtag NSS2016 today. Opportunity to advance the vision he outlined in Prague of stopping the spread of nuclear weapons." Some 500 people liked that tweet. Secretary of Energy Ernest Moniz is also prolific on Twitter Thursday. His handle is at Ernest Moniz, that's M-O-N-I-Z. He tweeted, "This is important. The president hosts the fourth nuclear security summit this week. There has been real progress since the first." And then he replied to his own tweet to state facts that support the statement. I mean, he sent out about 10. And just to give you a couple, he said the number of facilities with nuclear material continues to decline and that 15 countries have opened new centers for nuclear security training and international cooperation since 2009.
Interesting. Well, now, what's the latest on the U.S. domestic politics?
I know you just talked to Jim Malone about Donald Trump's visit to the RNC, and he actually tweeted about it, too. So the GOP presidential frontrunner Donald Trump had a surprise meeting with RNC, or the Republican National Committee, here in D.C. And after the meeting, he tweeted, "Just had a very nice meeting with RNC Chief Reince Priebus and the Republican Party. Looking forward to bringing the party together, and it will happen." More than 14,000 people like that tweet. Jim?
All right. Thank you very much, G. And be sure to stick with us. We're going to be talking to Jim Malone about that in just a moment. And G, of course, tweets for our program's account at VOA_IE. You'll want to follow that stream as well as her own account at G. Abby Lee. You can follow me as well on Twitter at VOA Stevenson. This is VOA.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump has met just a short time ago with Republican National Committee officials right here in Washington. An open push is being made within the party to deny the controversial billionaire real estate developer the presidential nomination at the party's upcoming convention in July. VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone joins us with more on this surprise development.
Apparently, the word coming out was it was a meeting to address some concerns that Trump has had about how delegates are being allocated. Don't forget, under our system, it's generally they reflect the results of the primaries and caucuses, but there are rather intricate and localized formulas for how delegates are chosen. And in the case of, say, Louisiana, Ted Cruz was able to nab a few more delegates just through the process of appointing delegates for the state. Trump was complaining about that. But these are some of the challenges he's going to face now. And given the recent turmoil in the campaign in the last several days, I think that in the party establishment, there's probably more concern than ever that as Trump moves closer to the nomination, there may be some regret among party leaders that we may be heading down a path we don't want to go.
Trump is, of course, extremely popular among his supporters, and that's why he's in the position he is now. But overall, across the nation, there is a lot of discontent when you mention the name Donald Trump, and history really hasn't been kind to nominees who weren't that popular.
No, that's for sure. And I think what's most alarming, particularly with women voters, some of the statistics we're seeing in some of the polling now where more than 70% of women in some surveys are saying that they oppose Trump, wouldn't vote for him. That is going to be a real problem for the Republican Party. They did an autopsy report after Mitt Romney lost in 2012. And some of the conclusions were, A, you have to do a better job in the Republican Party to reach out to women and also to minority groups, especially Hispanic voters. Well, Trump is apparently hurting himself with women voters. And we already know that he set the tone early on with his anti-illegal immigration talk, how that's hitting Hispanic American voters. So I just think if this goes on for a while, it's going to be fascinating to watch how the party tries to wrestle with this. But it's something that is not fully in their control, as we have seen from the beginning.
And if not Trump, we presume Ted Cruz. And does Ted Cruz hit those demographics that they did in that autopsy report?
Right. And, you know, just in the last few days, Ted Cruz has all of a sudden started having some events that are geared specifically toward women voters. So he obviously sees an opening here. I just think that if they are able to block Trump from getting the amount of votes, delegates before the convention, and it goes into multiple ballots, kind of all bets are off. It could be Cruz. It still could be Trump somehow. Or it could be a dark horse emerging from nowhere. This has been such an unpredictable campaign season that it would be really kind of scary to go out on a limb too far here. But I think a loss in Wisconsin would be a stumble for Trump. And that sets up what happens later in April. Well, there are some primaries, particularly in the Northeast, in our area, Delaware, up in Pennsylvania, New York. That may be area more favorable to Trump. He may be able to recover. Or if this is truly damaging, he won't do as well and he won't get the delegates he needs. So the intrigue absolutely continues.
Well, the fun never stops on the campaign trail, especially in this election cycle. And I can tell you, VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone is having a ball this time of year. Jim, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jim.
Many U.S. voters have jokingly said they will move to Canada if Donald Trump is elected president. International Business Times reporter Lauren Lyons-Cole has actually investigated possible relocation destinations.
In terms of your wallet, I mean, most people default to Canada as their destination, but really, for expats living there, more than a quarter of them are feeling stretched, like they don't have enough disposable income. So Americans who want to go outside our borders might want to look at some of these other countries that we've found are better for your wallet.
Well, let's stick with this hemisphere for the moment and see where U.S. citizens could go fairly close to the United States.
Mexico trumps Canada. The expats who live in Mexico are earning $50,000 or less per year, but a majority of them say that they are very happy with their financial situation. And a big part of that is just that your dollar goes further. The cost of living isn't as bad.
There are several destinations in Asia that Americans have long known about, but you've zeroed in on a couple very interesting spots.
Singapore is not a cheap destination by any means, but most expats who are working and living there are managers, so they're earning a better salary, and they're very, very pleased with raising a family there. So if you've got kids and you're focused on good education, good childcare, and you're willing to pay a little bit more for it, Singapore is a very popular destination.
And I understand if you like Thai food, well, you can actually get the real stuff.
Thailand is a popular destination for many people, and anyone who lived there or has lived there or has visited there always raves about the country. It's not great for working abroad, but if you're a retiree looking for excellent health care and affordable housing, nice people, good food, Thailand is a really popular, great destination for your budget.
Mr. Trump, in some circles, is not doing too well among women voters in the United States, but there is a potentially good place for women to go.
Women really love Malta. It's a small island country located off the coast of Italy, beautiful destination with really good health care and great work-life balance. And interestingly, they have a large percentage of expats who work in the video game industry. So if that's something you've been interested in breaking into or just enjoy participating in, that's another good reason to check out Malta.
Some great tips from Lauren Lyons-Cole. She is an International Business Times reporter who has written a great article, Planning a Move to Canada if Donald Trump is Elected President. Choose one of these budget-friendly countries instead. Lauren, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
Have you ever considered putting graffiti on your walls as art? Well, you could break out a few spray cans and do it yourself if you like, or choose from a collection of works by the elusive British graffiti artist Banksy. He's done stuff on walls, screen prints, and other methods, which all go up for auction in Southern California next month. As International Edition's David Byrd explains, the street art is expected to fetch more than $1 million.
You know his work, even if no one knows his face. Banksy, the celebrated graffiti artist, has a unique talent for coupling stencil art with absurd themes. In one piece, a spike-haired young man with a bandana over his face holds an anarchist flag. His mother, properly dressed in a flowered skirt and sweater, straightens his bandana as if he were just going out to play. In another work, a young man dressed in black appears ready to toss something at a demonstration, but it's a bouquet of flowers. Still another work has the crucified Jesus holding shopping bags instead of being nailed to the cross. Now some of Banksy's art is up for sale. The top piece at Julian Street in Contemporary Art Auction April 30th is expected to be Banksy's 2002 Happy Choppers, an original spray paint stencil of Apache helicopters that are wearing pink bows. It was created in central London and is expected to fetch around $150,000. Michael Doyle is the consignment director at Julian's in West Hollywood.
Typically, our works sell for over the high estimate. So Morons right behind me, we just sold. That was estimated for $20,000 to $25,000. Not the same print, but another version of this. And that ended up selling for closer to $35,000. So we've typically achieved over estimated results with all our Banksy pieces.
Other Banksy works include the prints Nola, a 2009 Hurricane Katrina image of a girl holding an umbrella with the rain falling inside it. There's also Bomb Love and Crazy Horse, which Banksy created during a stay in New York. Michael Doyle says that many of the items were made just before Banksy became an international superstar.
But also, a lot of these prints were made at a time in, like, 2006 when he wasn't a big deal and people would buy them for cheap and, you know, keep throw them wherever, not take care of them. And so, you know, all the stuff that he made originally is still not all around. So it is, for example, the Bomb Love. This is a mint condition Bomb Love. This is signed by Banksy himself. And so there's not very many, you know, pieces like this. This was made in 2004. That's still in mint condition before Banksy became the huge phenomenon he is today.
Adding to the mystique of Banksy's art is the artist's refusal to reveal his face. He's not on Facebook or Twitter and eschews the public eye. Michael Doyle says that Banksy's anonymity adds to the fascination with his work.
That he's anonymous is, you know, something that only adds to the lore. It causes people to speculate who he is, what he's going to do next. There's no, you know, official person to ask, or, you know, he kind of sends out his messages through the media. But I think that that, you know, fascinates people and keeps them involved and paying attention to what's next and what he's doing.
In addition to works by Banksy, the auction will feature a collection of more than 30 works by the iconic street artist Shepard Fairey, the designer of the 2008 Hope poster featuring U.S. President Barack Obama. Other highlights include a complete set of Damien Hirst spin paintings and works by Jeff Koons, Andy Warhol, and from the Los Angeles Street Art Gallery. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
$1 million. Wow, Banksy is banking on a big sale. Our show's in the bank. You've been listening to International Edition, and you can find us at voanews.com. We're also on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Carl Starling. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. We thank you so much for joining us and hope the rest of your day is absolutely wonderful. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
More than 70 people were killed and more than 300 injured in a suicide bombing in a crowded park in Lahore, Pakistan, on Easter Sunday. Most of those killed were women and children. State Department spokesperson John Kirby condemned in the strongest terms the appalling terrorist attack in the eastern province of Punjab. Jamaat-ul-Ahrar, a splinter group of the Pakistani Taliban, has claimed responsibility for the attack, which they say was directed at Pakistani Christians. Though in the aftermath, it has become clear more Muslims than Christians lost their lives in the attack. Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif vowed to eradicate extremist ideologies from Pakistan after the Easter Sunday bombing. Our goal is not only to eliminate terror infrastructure, but also the extremist mindset, which is a threat to our way of life, Sharif said in a statement. We must take this war to the doors of the terrorist outfits before they are able to hit our innocent countrymen. Jamaat-ul-Ahrar has claimed responsibility for several big attacks in the past 2 years. It has previously carried out at least 2 major attacks in Lahore, one in 2015 that targeted 2 Christian churches, and another at the Wagah border between India and Pakistan in late 2014. Of Pakistan's 190 million people, approximately 1.5% of the total population is Christian, according to the latest census. But it is a community that has been targeted by extremist groups before. For example, in 2013, a suicide bombing at a church in Peshawar left more than 100 people dead, and a series of attacks at churches in Lahore left 14 dead. Attacks like these only deepen our shared resolve to defeat terrorism around the world, said spokesperson Kirby. And we will continue to work with our partners in Pakistan and across the region to combat the threat of terrorism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.